Chris Ballew.
Some say he is brown, and he will shake this town if he ever comes this way again.
Lead singer, frontman for the presidents of the United States. You remember their big hits? Peaches, Lump, a whole bunch of other stuff. Casper Baby Pants is his song, his career entertaining kids, writing beautiful songs about the passage of time and what it means to be silly and be whimsical and have fun and be afraid of supersonic motorcycles and what everything else you can imagine, as well as a deeper, to me, almost melancholic, but that may be unfair, maybe be incorrect, but just this deeper sense of the passage of time and kids getting older and all of us getting older and moving towards something deeper as we age and as we continue to live our lives on Earth. Here he is, President of the United States, as well as Casper Baby Pants, and I'm really glad to have you on the show today. I know my first question is, for students out there who are artists and who are wanting to pursue an artistic life in 2024, do you have any advice? Because
it's interesting because it's a very different landscape than the landscape I came up in. Because the landscape I came up in, well, in some ways it's different, in some ways it's not, really. The landscape I came up in it seemed like to me when I was in college in the 1980s that the world was very opaque, that it was very difficult to imagine a road into a successful life, you know, financially successful and creatively rewarding life. It just seemed really hard to understand where the doorways were that I could get in. So I kind of went the opposite direction and said, all right, I'm going to ignore the well-worn path of, say, trying to get a major label record deal and get on the radio and all that stuff. I'm going to set up my life so that I'm able to influence what is inside my sphere of control. Number one, identify what's inside my sphere of control. I can write songs. I can record them on my 4-track. I can play shows anytime I want. I was in Boston at the time and in New York, so I was like, you know, I can go busk on the street or in the subway and play a show and, you know, get money. And so it was that I would set up a feedback loop that was manageable and a feedback loop that I could influence myself, you know. And I kind of decided, you know, early on I had sort of a dual relationship with the idea of fame. One was, I don't want to depend on the traditional system to sort of anoint me as valuable and validate my creativity. The other was, I desperately want to be famous. So it was like,
Catch 22.
But I kind of felt like the path to success was by turning away from the traditional path and sort of doing what I want to do on a very small scale, and thereby attracting others who are interested in either collaborating or observing me do what I'm doing. And this, like, slowly builds. You know, I think it's tempting for people to want to shortcut the process. Think, well, you know, the old myth of, like, the movie star who's swimming at the hotel pool at the Hotel Roosevelt in L.A. and some casting director says, who's that kid in the pool? And then, like, all of a sudden you're famous. I mean, that does happen, but it's way more common that you have to set it up so that you can be happy without the, without the approval of a gatekeeper. These days, there are gatekeepers still, like in the same way that, you know, when my band got on MTV and got on the radio and signed a major label deal, those are the main three big gatekeepers that you had to get through back in the 90s. I think there are still gatekeepers now. There's, like, you know, people that curate playlists online. I guess, big deal now. But it's also way easier to get your music in front of a lot of people now. I mean, back in my day, I remember making cassettes and sending them to this thing called Fact Sheet 5. It was like a zine for other cassette culture people, and you would read little micro reviews of other people's work and just send them $5 to their P.O. box, and they'd send you a cassette. It was like Cro-Magnon Spotify, basically.
Yeah, I saw you in an interview discussing that in that little mini documentary, that documentary on you, where you said at that point in your life you thought, I've made it. This is what I'm going to do. This is it.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I'm in print, Ma. Like Navin Johnson in The Jerk. He's like, I'm in the phone book.
That's right. That had to have been amazing. Sorry, I didn't mean to jump in there.
No, that's okay. So, yeah, basically that's my answer. My answer is I think it's important to downsize your operation. And these days you can share your process of how you create on Instagram or Facebook or whatever you use, TikTok. It's kind of the same approach as I think people are lucky now because they can have so many eyeballs on them. But then sometimes I wonder if, I know in the Seattle scene, if you want to call it that, there was a real respect for the DIY approach, you know, do it yourself. Book your own shows, write your own songs, perform your own songs, And I think that sort of chemistry or whatever promoted individualism and it sort of motivated people to be unique. Like, what are other people not doing that I could do, kind of thing. And I don't know if the digital world promotes that as much or if it promotes conformity as much. I'm not 100% sure about that. Yeah. That's something to be aware of as you kind of like do your thing, document it, and share it with the world. Is that sharing trickling down and polluting your ability to be yourself and be uniquely creative?
Yeah, that's a great point. I remember also when 4-Tracks came out and how amazing that was. And now, just last week, I had this idea for a song, and I have a little project. I just record in my, home on Ableton, and I upload it directly to Bandcamp, and it can be out, in just a matter of, 30 minutes or something if I want it to be. It makes me wonder, do you think all of that availability and that ease of just seeming distribution, does that make it a little I wonder if it makes people lazier these days? I wonder if you guys put much more thought into every chord change and much more thought into your stuff because it wasn't so easily available. I wonder if that somehow cripples or kind of, I don't know, waters down the creativity a little bit.
Yeah, there maybe the fact is that, if you look at it like, say, the strata in a cliff face in Utah, and there's all these different strata, right? And say at the top there's the massively talented, the Michael Jacksons and the Beatles and all that, and then you go down to like the hobbyists and the people who basically suck. I kind of feel like maybe the occupants of each level of that strata are always there throughout history, and it's a matter of where the lens or the focus lands. Like right now, maybe we're focusing on the uber super talented and the people in the middle who are striving or something, and that's the story of our culture creatively right now. Or maybe we're focusing on the people who are really struggling down at the bottom. But I feel like every iteration of intensity of talent and drive and whatever is always happening. It's just kind of a matter of what we're aware of. So I guess with Instagram, I am amazed by the number of little children who are super proficient, like a little 8-year-old girl playing a Led Zeppelin song on drums and just killing it.
Right. Right.
Now did that 8-year-old girl playing crazy amounts of drums always exist? Has that strata in the cliff face always been there, but we only know about it now because it's shareable? I think so. I like to think that, because the more I learn about the history of music and I'm listening to this amazing podcast called A History of Rock and Roll in 500 Songs. Hmm. It's this forensic history of the birth and, trajectory of rock and roll. And there's just so much fluidity to it and so many characters and so many, it's almost like that whole thing, like we think Edison invented the light bulb, but there were 10 other people who arrived at that conclusion at the same time,
yeah,
you know?
That's right.
And there's no such thing as firsts and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, I feel like maybe like you said, like is the ease with which you can write and record a song and release it mm-hmm. polluting the content? And I think it's making a certain kind of content more accessible, which is maybe, you know, just okay songs.
Yeah, sure.
But it's also making like this incredible proficiency really available, you know, like people who can play 1,000 notes a second on guitar.
Oh my gosh.
The funny thing is those people get a lot of hits and everything.
Yeah, they should.
But I get nothing musically from those posts. You know, I immediately
here. Yeah.
Cuz it's like, how do I want to sit and listen to somebody playing 175th notes on guitar? And
What was the guy's name from he's fairly famous. He was from that band Nitro. I think his name might have been Michelangelo or something. He was like from the 80s kind of hair metal genre, but yeah, it's the same Michelangelo Battio that I'm being told, like he was like this super shredder, and like Buckethead. I saw Buckethead in concert
right
once or twice.
Actually, in some ways I do appreciate that proficiency, but I just don't want to listen, you know.
Yeah,
and there are brains out there that get very much turned on and get pleasure from that. So
sure,
that's the thing is, there is a brain out there that will be turned on by you. It may not be a billion brains. It might be 100 brains,
but
our brains out there that will receive what you're doing and appreciate it. I just watched a movie tonight, a movie called Spaceman by Adam Sandler movie.
Okay.
I found it brilliant, just like a brilliant movie. And I kind of went online to be like, let's hear all the people talking about how great this movie is. And it was the opposite. Everybody hated it.
Hmm. Okay.
And I was like, what? That's so bizarre. But it just reinforces that idea that like there are as many brains as there are creative expressions. And so you just have to connect with them.
Yeah, no doubt. I remember being in the mid 90s, I was in a college rock, just, you know, cover band doing that bar scene thing. We did a bunch of that stuff. And I remember when you guys came out, and I remember my impression of the rock scene in like 95, 96 was like, okay, the people I were around, you had to have the perfect gear. I really was impressed by when I first saw like videos of you guys playing. You know, people had to have the perfect, you know, Les Paul set up with the perfect, you know, everything. And you're playing this two-string bass, you know what I mean? And, like, people were talking about, I remember people were talking about, they were like, what's this Peaches guy? That's what a friend of mine referred to as. Is what's this, people playing, like, did he break his strings? I was like, listen, man, that's obviously intentional. And I thought that was super interesting. And a little random question I have. Did other musicians give you flack because you don't set up your guitars the way that we're all supposed to set up your guitars? I'm curious if people appreciated that like I do, or did you get some side eye glances over that?
No, we never got any sort of criticism from other musicians. In fact, Kim File from Soundgarden,
who is
one of these guys who plays 172 notes a minute or a second. He was our champion. He loved the band, and he kind of our like ambassador back to the grungies. And he kind of said like, "Hey, everybody, these guys are a real band. Check them out." We did the two string thing. It's all part of it is aesthetics. Like, I just felt good playing that. A friend of mine, Mark Sandman, who was the lead singer of a band called Morphine from Boston. He played a slide two string, and he had a version sitting around in his studio one day that was a version that you could play with not with a slide, but with fingering on the fretboard. And I picked it up and it just really felt good. I felt like, oh, this is also another expression of my overall idea of minimalist living, like things within my, you know, influence that can express a DIY attitude. Like nothing says DIY like two strings on a guitar. Like anybody can play this guitar, you know? It's not about, it's, it was an outward statement maybe against proficiency and more toward, you know, kind of like dumbing down, I mean, not that we weren't, we were proficient at playing the songs and writing the songs and all that, but it wasn't about, you know, that sort of muscular presentation of capability that everybody was sort of into. It was more like, hey, look, we're dorky and stupid and we're trying to rock out. You can too. Was kind of what that expressed. And then it also was a, you know, great talking. Our name was a talking point, and the fact that we played these weird instruments was a talking point. So it just kind of really fed into the whole DIY vibe.
Yeah, I definitely, it definitely was a striking thing. Cause I mean, it's arguably, I mean, to do interesting things with two strings is arguably harder to than, you know, using four or five. And like, and as far as, you know, I always like to ask people too, like, what's your relationship like with those two huge songs? You know, I know a lot of people who have hits, you know, I've heard a whole gamut of things. Like if you take like just the verse, what I call the verse groove from Peaches, like that's interesting stuff you and the guitarist are doing. That's just interesting arrangement. It's really interesting. But like, what is your, I haven't heard anyone and I haven't exhausted my, you know, Casper Baby Pants, Chris Ballou YouTube watching by any means, but I haven't seen anybody like directly ask you, what is your relationship with the song Peaches and or Lump? Like, what is that like to have a song that well known? Is it a love hate or what?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I, before the president's, well, the, after the president started and before we hit it big, I took time out from the president's to tour with Beck as a side musician.
Yeah, right, right.
And he was not fond of the Loser song. Okay, and I sort of, I took a view from that. I was like, you know what? I am not going to have that happen to me if that kind of, if I'm lucky enough to have that kind of situation befall me, which eventually I was like, so we had a rule in the president's where if we looked down at the set list and any one of us wasn't 100% excited to play every song, take whatever song was not feeling 100% great and just get rid of it and work on a different song to take its place. So the idea was that when we looked down at the set list, we were like, I can't wait to play that song, and I can't wait to play that song, and I can't wait to play that song.
Yeah.
And believe it or not, Lump was kind of a dud when we first played it because a lot of our stuff was kind of bouncy and groovy and country and funky. And then we played this kind of four on the floor straight rock song and people kind of went, oh, okay, that's interesting for 2 minutes. And now let's get back to bouncing. So anyway, bottom line is the short headline is I love both of those songs. I love all of our songs. There's no song that we ever released that I don't love, love, love. And I still pop on a president's record every once in a while. And I'm just like, wow, I love this album. So yeah, Lump especially, I never felt, whenever I played it, I never felt bored. I felt like it was the very first time we were playing that song every time we played it. It was, it never got old.
And then there's
Peaches.
That- Go ahead,
yeah, Peaches maybe a tiny bit of road wear on that one, but also just when we hit the end part and we started kicking it out, man, it just it was never boring. So yeah, I love them. I love them.
That's great to hear. Yeah, to me it seems like. And by the way, side note, I imagine I was lucky enough to meet Beck one time after a show when he played Nashville, but I would imagine that touring with Beck has to be a smorgasbord of stories in itself. Is that safe
to
say?
Oh boy! Yeah, many stories. It was a magical time. It was like my first. It was an incredibly weird, surreal. I was the only band member not from LA, so I actually lived with him and drove all over LA. You know, philosophizing with him when he had to do like a radio thing on KCRW or something, I would go along. We were kind of a little bit of a duo for a minute.
Yeah.
We got ready to go on tour for the first time. So,
Yeah, really great. I would love to reconnect with him now and sort of hash out the last 30 years, but haven't had that opportunity yet. But yeah, we've run into each other since I stopped. I did the first two tours with him and then went back to doing the Presidents.
Yeah.
But I've run into him a few times out in the world, and we've always had a really good reunion. So.
Yeah, I remember his show when I was like 19 when I saw his show. It was like this really, it was this very, you know, artistic, very odd show. I really loved it. Very unexpected. And then when we met him, for some reason, I was expecting him to be, I don't know, super shy or super, I don't know. I had some kind of expectation, I think, from his artistic presentation. But he talked to us for like 10 minutes, and he was just seemed like this kind of just very gracious, you know, soft-spoken guy. And anyway, sure. How old were
you? What year was that show you saw?
Well, I know that Odelay was out. So if that.
Oh, yeah. I was gone by then.
Yeah, right. It was Odelay. I think it was on the Odelay tour, possibly. But I don't know. It was a small club in Nashville. But nonetheless, it's like when I hear Peaches and when I hear Lump, you know, those two big songs, I hear a little bit of Casper Baby Pants in there, trying to shift toward that. Because I know you have I know you have limited time today, and I would love to talk to you about the 90s all day. Like, you were a rock star in the 1990s. People who, like me, were nobody musicians in the 1990s going to college, that seems like you need to write a book or something. We just want to know, what was that like, you know?
I know. I mean, it's crossed my mind to write something, but I don't think I'm ready yet.
Yeah, so. Sure. Well, where you really came into our life. So I said, as we spoke before the show, like in an email, you Casper Baby Pants is part of our family mythos. And that is not an overstatement. When our daughter was very young, I heard somebody sent one of your songs and they said, "Hey, listen to this. They Might Be Giants song. This is great." And I heard it immediately. And I thought, this is not the Giants. Who is this? So we got deep. I think I know a lot of your songs. I know a lot of Casper songs. I love them. So it's a very great honor to speak with someone who is kind of mythic, as you know, through your Casper Baby Pants art. So
I think
the lyrics in, you know, Lump and some of the lyrics in Peaches, specifically that amazingly lyrical line that says, "Take a little nap where the roots all twist," like, there's playfulness. There's playfulness there, and like I think there's early Casper stuff there. Is that too much assumptive, or is that were you?
Oh no, you're exactly you're exactly right. So the evolution of that relationship between Presidents and Casper was that when I was doing the Presidents, when we first started out, we were a small little rock band pretending to be a big deal. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like it was a joke. That's why we called ourselves the Presidents of the United States of America, because we were these three dorks trying to rock, and we'd never end up obviously occupying the highest position on the charts or the highest office in the land, if you will.
Right.
It was a joke. And then we became a real rock band because we had to stand up in front of 50,000 people on a racetrack in Germany and entertain the people in the back. So, and that got a little less interesting to me, and my mind started to wander, and I started to think, you know, there's something else that I should be maybe exploring. And about 15 years of experimenting finally landed on kids' music. When I met my second wife, Kate, and saw her artwork, every adjective I used to describe that art was the adjectives I wanted to use to describe this music that I was trying to figure out outside the Presidents. So all of a sudden it became clear that it was kids' music, and I felt so liberated, like no longer at the mercy of the culture of cool or, you know, promoting my personality in a way of trying to win over adult taste. You know, little kids, I totally have always connected with, especially 0 to 5-year-olds. I feel like in that range, they are like little Buddhas. They're like little enlightened beings, you know, and they learn to lose that, and regaining it is part of why meditation is such a big deal and spirituality. We're all trying to get back to being 2.5 and not knowing how the world works, but knowing the parts. So anyway, finding that purpose and, you know, being also part of putting drops in the scale that were on the positive side, as far as like, you know, relieving boredom and stress for families. I really wanted to make the albums, the Casper albums, work like a tool. Like, you should be able to put them on in the car if the family is having a hard time and everybody's hot and tired and pissed off and they all have to pee and they're hungry. You should be able to put the album in and it should help everybody in the car, grown-ups included, to lighten up, you know?
Yeah.
So with that purpose in mind, my creativity just exploded. And I always used to say, like, the Casper Baby Pants thing and the President's thing are really the same planet, the same core, like the same molten core of the planet, which like innocence, silliness. The outer shell of the planet with the President's was innuendo, you know, like a double entendres and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I never felt super comfortable with that chemistry as a songwriter. Like, I didn't feel like I had control of that chemistry. So getting rid of that shell, the outer shell of adult humor, just created a song volcano.
No doubt. How 19 albums, is that right? Of
362 songs, 19 albums, 1,237 shows in 12 years.
Man, that's, and I've seen videos of like several of your shows, and like those kids are just nuts. It's beautiful. Like, it just looks like crazy. You said somewhere else they're like the most punk rock shows you've played, and like you told the story about the kid with the diaper just taking over the soundboard and, you know, kind of raising hell.
Yeah, it really was like a return to the DIY thing that I built my foundation on, because I did run the business myself. I recorded the albums at home. I, you know, advanced shows. I was the roadie. I was the booking agent. I was the performer. I was the merch seller. It was like a total DIY thing, which really felt fantastic. Oh, I loved going. Yeah. But also, it was really successful, and I never promoted it. This is another nugget for people out there thinking about how to do your thing in the world. I did do some posting on social media and stuff like that about new albums and ideas that I was having about the Casper thing, but not a ton. And I only hired a publicist on one album just to experiment, and it didn't move the needle at all. My approach was like, I'm going to spend all the energy I would spend promoting this on writing better songs, having more time to be critical of my own songwriting and really focus the music and get it to where it's achieving my goal of entertaining the entire family for real, not just paying lip service to that idea. So I put all my energy into that and figured, you know, happy parents will tell other parents about it. And it was a slow burn, but it worked. So if you have the patience, pouring your energy into the actual, you know, thing you're making or song you're writing or, you know, product you're creating is, I think, a way better use of energy than spending it on tirelessly promoting something mediocre.
Yeah, right. And that goes back to your strata discussion of, you know, different
levels
of things. So, like, make the product, put yourself into the product. And, yeah, there does seem to be a focus on, well, if I can get enough views or if I can get enough people to follow me on Bandcamp or whatever the case is, when maybe the focus should be better spent on the art. And I listening to your arrangements, my understanding is you play every instrument on the Casper songs. Is that correct?
Yeah, pretty much. Okay. I mean, there was a phase there where I had a couple of guys who would play with me live. They played percussion and keyboard, and they played on a few tracks. I didn't ever basic track, like, build a song with them, but they would come in and overdub.
Yeah, okay.
On stuff.
Okay. Yeah, what?
So, yeah, there's a few guest musicians and guest singers for sure, but the bulk of it is definitely my efforts. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember back. Our daughter is almost 10 now, so this would have been like, you know, 8 years ago. The first song I remember that I was kind of really struck by something was Stompy the Bear. And I remember there's the intro. It goes through the intro. You do the hook. And then there's just that complete slam stop. And that little organ, that little keyboard riff comes in. And that was the thing that kind of perked up my ears musically. Because I wasn't expecting that. It was like so minimalist and like just...
here's this tasty keyboard riff, you know, and I'm thinking to myself, this is a song about a bear, but I'm legitimately jamming to it. Like, I find your arrangements really interesting. I'd really love it. Like, you may not remember, but that particular song, Stompy the Bear, is my daughter's one of her
favorites. Oh, yeah, I remember that little boop-a-doop-boop-boop-boop, yeah.
Yeah, how long did it take? About,
what's that?
Oh, so I was going to say, how long did it take to produce that song completely?
Oh, my God, not long. In fact, yeah, that song's strange. I don't remember making it up. It just sort of poured out fully formed. That was a real joy to just capture that song because it wasn't labored at all. It just kind of fell out fully formed, and I just had a delightful time recording it. It's almost like I didn't write it. It's really weird. Mm. But I took a lot of cues from the Beatles and George Martin, you know, like making the solo section of a song its own little overture or little, like, maybe a song within the song kind of thing, where maybe the instruments change and there's a new melody that you can hook onto and stuff like that. So, yeah, pretty much every time I had an opportunity for solo, it was an opportunity to have a little, like, song inside the song. So that's kind of what I was after there.
Yeah, definitely. And it definitely seems like there's two types of songs. Like, one, I think of them as, like, there's kids romps, like that song, a little bit like Butterfly Driving a Car, like a lot of those just wild, you know, whatever the duck song. I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of that title. But there's also there's also these songs that to me seems like something deeper is going on, like Wanna Stop Time. And a great example to me is Made of Light. Like, to me, it's, I often think there's it seems to me like you're dealing with these, like, just something deeper in a lot of these songs.
No, you're absolutely right. Yeah. Those are kind of my moments to sort of, well, maybe not in the direction of the loss a parent feels as a child grows up.
Yeah.
And, you know, how you want to hold on to moments and acknowledging that. And, you know, that's another thing I loved about the Casper thing is because my philosophy about the value of being in service to that 0 to 5 year old range and their parents, that's just a really cosmic, amazing, earth-shattering time in the process of making a new life. And not only did I want to have kind of the silly songs and the story songs and characters in the songs, but then, you know, throw something on there that's deeper that maybe the kid won't get when they're 4, but they might get it when they're 14 or, you know, when they look back on their own childhood. And then, you know, like a song like Made of Light is trying to acknowledge the, trying to kind of, speak to the nature of reality being more like an energetic experience than naming a tree and a rock and the grass or whatever, but looking at it more like an abstract, almost psychedelic experience, which I think little kids, maybe when they're, you know, 6 months to 2 years old, are having that experience. You know, they don't know the names of them. Yeah. They just know the energy. And that is wonderful. And that goes hand in hand with my own, like, spiritual development and, you know, listening to people like Ram Dass and Alan Watts and getting these ideas about how to perceive reality in a way that feels not as attached, not as fearful. And that ended up sort of easing into the music I'm making now, which is exclusively pretty much about the, you know, my relationship to being alive, to death, to having a body, to nature. And so I'm kind of exploring that. And those lullabies in the Casper phase, I wrote so many cosmic lullabies that they turned into my new style, basically. Yeah. And so I'm six records into this new palette that I'm working with. In fact, I'm mastering my seventh record right now. And I'm putting those out 2 a year in June and July. And it's kind of what I'm doing now. So it kind of eased me into my own future.
It's interesting how, like, so there's, like, the just the all out. You said you had this desire to be famous, and that culminated with, I mean, you made it through those MTV gatekeepers. I mean, you went from that footage, like, at the Pink Pop Festival, which I know you said you grew tired of those big things. But that it's just this incredible, huge rock star life going into the whimsy of Casper and kind of leading you now to this deeper exploration, which it isn't. Your new albums are just for free on your website. Is that right?
They're on all the streamers,
yeah,
Spotify, right, and Apple Music and all that. But yeah, they're up for free on my website. I'm not in a position where I need to make money from music anymore. So I'm really excited to give those away for free just for people to enjoy. I mean, you can go to Bandcamp and give me a dollar if you want, but
yeah, it helps.
I have a tip
jar
in Bandcamp just for those people who might email. Some people email me then and they're like, I want to pay for your albums.
Yep.
So I tell them to go there, but,
Yeah.
I don't know what's next, but, I'll be ready for it when it happens.
Oh man. I love that idea. You know, we're like the 0 to 5 year old see something energetic that is maybe actual reality, and it takes our whole lives to get back there. And it's just great that you're able to like walk that path, which hopefully, I mean, most thoughtful people do walk that path, in one way or the other. And even if you're not thoughtful, I think people walk it without knowing it.
Yeah, sure. There's other ways to express it. I mean, just, you know, being of service, feeding the poor, donating to services that take care of people in need.
Yeah.
Traditional, religion also offers people gatherings, go to church, be together, sing together. All those things are valuable and different expressions of the same idea. I guess I've always kind of been driven to brush away the artifice or the human-made parts of the pursuit of perspective and try to just really see nature for what it is, just this like vibrating, brick of energy. It's interesting because the way I'm writing songs now is very intuitive, very like songs come in bits and pieces that are seem unrelated, maybe over the course of a couple weeks or a week. And I just receive these little parts and bits. And then all of a sudden I realize, oh, that chord progression goes with that concept. And they've always meant to be together. And let me just kind I'll improvise, make messes with the lyrics. It's way more intuitive. In The Presidents and Casper, it was more like, I have a goal. I have a character. I'm trying to communicate this visual image or this little story or scene. And now it's way more abstract and kind of intuitive and loose. And it's a whole different thing. So yeah, it's really fun. I'm having the time of my life.
Yeah. It sounds
like, and I'm basically just making these records 'cause I want to hear them, So
yeah, what's the best? I was thinking to him, I was just about to ask you, so what's the response been? And then I also kind of edited myself and thought, that's not the point, but you know what I mean? It sounds like it's a thing you're doing for you, but I'm sure the response, you've had a response from fans and from people checking it out. Are people embracing this organic new path, or do they just want more Casper? What's your take on that?
Well, I do get a lot of requests to get back on the Casper pony and do some more shows, which I'm pretty sure I won't do. I'm really retired from performing. My relationship to performing has really kind of ended. It's interesting. It was such a big part of me, but I kind of, when the pandemic hit and I had to cancel everything, I felt very relieved. And I thought I should explore that. I should feel sad, but I feel extremely relieved. And, so my relationship to the pressures of performing has been very intense for a long time. And so I do get a lot of communications like, do another President show, do another Casper show.
Yeah.
So I'm just like, I like to say never say never, but probably never, but you never say never. So, but yeah, as far as response to the new stuff, a few things here and there, and that's really gratifying, but I'm pretty careful to, I'm enjoying flying under the radar or beyond the radar right now. And my last album, my last solo album, actually for some weird reason, kind of caught a tiny bit of fire on Spotify and had like 45,000 listens or something, which for me right now is
good.
It's pretty bad. That's great. I mean, I see some songs of my new stuff that have like 500 listens, and I'm like, yay, boy, if kid that sent cassettes into Fact Sheet 5.
That's right. That's right.
If I sold 500 cassettes back then, I would have like lost my mind. Yeah. I'm anchoring myself in the joy of making a full circle and being that 25-year-old or 24-year-old kid again who is thrilled when I get $5 in my P.O. box for my cassette. I really want to rest there, you know? Yeah. So hearing from people is nice, but I am cautious about it, you know, because my last record did seem to catch a little bit of fire. So I could feel it sort of infecting my choices for this new record.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, sure.
I could feel it like, well, that record was good, so maybe I should put these songs on because they're like that record. And I'm like, oh, shit, no.
Yeah.
I need to do what makes me feel good. I also have a couple of, for the new stuff, I have a couple of co-producers that give me feedback. So that helps me figure out, you know, validate that I'm on the right track and these songs are actually worth releasing. So,
it sounds like you're on a great track. And finally, I really super, it's been great talking with you. But students often walk that line between, you know, they come from middle class or even, you know, poor socioeconomic backgrounds, and money is just a factor that they have to, you know, they can't just completely dismiss money. So I have a lot of students who come to me and they find out that I spent my 20s, you know, playing music and, you know, unemployed other than that. And I kind of have, you know, I'm not like super traditional, professor at all. I'm just, you know, I'm not like an academic. I'm not super smart. I just like teaching stuff. So they figure things out and they say, okay, so I have a question then. I want to do X, but I don't think I make any money that way. And I always try to impress upon them, yes, of course we need money to, you know, we need money. Don't think you don't need money, but you don't only need money. So like, I think maybe my last question for you might be, do you get people who are flummoxed or somehow confused? Because I bet right now the presidents could get back together and go play some shows and you could play your hits and play some songs. And I bet you guys could make tons of money if it was only about money. Do some people wonder about your kind of walking away from that and going deeper into just organically doing stuff you want to do? And you just said, you know, you're not motivated by money at this point. So do people sometimes act strange about that?
Yeah, and they're called my bandmates.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. Every year, some promoter in Australia sends us this crazy offer.
Wow.
And my drummer, Jason, who really, and Dave, our guitar player, would love to take advantage of that and do it. But I just don't want to do it. I've been doing this behavioral concept lately where, do you know who Marie Kondo is?
The sparking joy person, right?
Yes, exactly.
I do.
I'm not applying that to things like she does, which is great, but I'm applying it to my behaviors. Like a little over a year ago, I stopped drinking alcohol because it was a little bit of a problem for me. And I felt this like lightness and I kind of was like, ooh, that's good. And it's since become so the idea of drinking makes me feel heavy. And the idea of not drinking makes me feel like, ah, there it is. I'm light. Like, the idea of not playing live ever again makes me feel so light.
Oh,
like,
wow.
I'm back. I'm back with my four track in 1983 in my bedroom, pure creative enjoyment with no idea that it's supposed to be, you know, huge or famous or, successful or anything. I'm just back there. So when I think about performing live, I just go, ugh, just like so heavy.
Yeah.
I'd have to buy all the gear. I'd have to use, you know, my ears are really messed up from loud rock and roll. And I've really promised the ears I would not go back to that format. So yeah, I mean, that's a long way of answering it, but yeah, I do get, I have to every year, for the last couple of years anyway, I have to sort of talk Dave and Jason down from from the reuniting. We've already reunited twice, so
Right, right.
We've broken up twice, reunited once. So we've done that arc, you know. That story's been told.
Yeah. It's ironic, too, because like you said in the beginning, I latched on heavily when you said you had this desire to be famous. And unless you want to come back for a part two, I'm definitely not going to ask you what do you think is behind that desire to be famous, because that's a complex thing. And now it seems like you're evolving back. It does seem like a full circle evolution that somehow revolves around, I don't know if I'm going to say a rejection of fame, but like just that lightness you feel is worth more than money. And that's
yeah, it's great. Not really. I'm not a renunciate. I'm not renouncing anything really. I'm really just trying to embrace what I do want rather than defining myself saying what I don't want or what I can't achieve. I'm trying to define myself by what I'm capable of achieving. Again, you know, when you talk about people, you know, students coming to you like, how do I do what I want to do and make money?
Yeah,
I think it's a matter of just changing how you live, if possible.
Mm-hmm.
There's a huge tiny house movement. You know, there's mm-hmm. alternative. There's people who are building ADUs, little attached dwelling units in their backyards to rent out for low money. We're dealing with a big housing crisis here on Vashon Island where I live, and I'm participating in helping figure that out. So I recognize that it's difficult to just exist in this economic climate for sure. But I think if you're really dedicated to what you want to do, I mean, you know, when I was in my 20s and I was doing my own thing and I had to pay rent and all that, I just got the stupidest jobs I could, so I didn't use any brain power at my job.
Right.
So I could use all my brain power on music when I got home. And one time I got my rent down in Boston to $75 because I lived in a punk rock house and shared a room with another kid.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I mean, that was $75 in 1988. So I don't know what that is now, but anyway, I mean, it's easy for me to talk like that, and I know it's difficult to actually do, you know, that to make those kind of choices and to live without certain things. But I guess that's the only advice. I mean, that's the advice I have because that's what I did.
Yeah, right, right.
I just downsized my life to the point where I could survive and spend the precious energy I had outside of work and paying rent on music.
Oh, that's it. Yeah, that's it. You mentioned Alan Watts and Dawson. I remember reading the book, you know, years ago, and like we joke around in our house about Alan Watts' dreadful bell, you know, like the notion of, you know, things.
Yeah, I love listening to his lectures online.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
That one about the ocean. Have you're familiar with that? I don't know the name of it.
No, I'm not familiar with the one about the ocean.
It's just Alan Watts' Ocean will bring it up. But nonetheless.
Okay, I'll for that when we're done.
Well,
I do yoga every morning. And so I listen to I go through phases where I listen to Ram Dass and phases where I listen to Alan Watts. And boy, they really inform a lot of lyrical content in my new music too. So.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Yoga is a great, I love that too. I'm trying to give up sugar currently. And like, it's just, it's just very difficult. And I think I've read somewhere you did that successfully. I may be incorrect, but was that one?
Yeah. I have this ability. It turns out to take things that are not good for me and sort of over time, neutralize them in my mind. Sort of like right now, cake, pie, cupcakes, alcohol. It doesn't even look like food to me. When people eat a cupcake, I'm like, why are you putting that sculpture in your mouth? I don't think eating food.
What about buttered noodles though? Is that okay?
Oh, buttered noodles. I'll eat all day long. I'm going to go eat some now. If you say the magic words, buttered noodles, I'm out of here. I got to go.
The sugar thing, like I was convinced, like, okay, it's gonna take me a couple months and I'll have it totally nailed, but like no, it's been a long embarrassing journey. I mean, I'm not, you know, I don't conflate that with any kind of,
well, yeah, I mean, my journey with alcohol was intense and embarrassing and long slog, really, you know, self-medicating through a bad marriage. And, you know, that boring, the boring time on the road is really easy to fill with alcohol. So, but boy, I'm like 14, 15 months into sobriety, and just, it's amazing. I have so much more brain space. The, you know, the space I was using for negotiation around alcohol is open now and available. I don't need to, you know, spiral anymore.
Yeah.
It's really nice.
Yeah.
And as you know, I'm not saying alcohol is evil or bad, but it sure is nice for me to not have it in my life.
Yeah, that's what I keep hearing. You know, you are understanding what works for you, and you have goals that are working for you. And sometimes if that doesn't work for other people, you respectfully are focused on, you know, we all have to be aware of what we need and what is going to work for us. And I know you got to go. Listen, I want to say this was amazing. I really appreciate it. You can come back anytime. You just let me know. And we didn't even get to talk about several songs, but if you have any thoughts about Just For You as the very last thing, I can't believe how beautiful that people would do bad things to get melodies and chord changes like that. That's such a beautiful song, Just For You.
Here comes the sunset just for you, little baby. Here comes the sunset just for you. Prettiest thing that you've ever seen. Day to night, we are in between. Here comes the sunset just for you, little baby. Here comes the night sky just for you, little baby. Here comes the night sky just for you. Inky blue, dark and white, daytime creatures run and hide. Here comes the night sky just for you, little baby.
Here comes Just For You.
That's
such a
beautiful song.
Have you seen the video?
No, I haven't.
Got to check out the video. I made a video of all these, I sort of crudely animated photos of me when I was a baby and my parents. And I can barely watch it without crying.
Oh my gosh. Okay. All right. Here's what we should do. I'm going to go watch the Just For You video, and you should go eat some buttered noodles.
Okay. Well, but I will say I very much appreciate you, that you appreciate that song and it resonates with you. Yeah. That whole sort of theme of the love between a child and parents and time passing and that melancholy and nostalgia for that connection was really satisfying to mix into the Casper, you know, thing.
It's
really, really, it scratched, for me as a songwriter, it scratched a real itch to kind of not only have the fun, silly stuff, but also have this kind of, you know, true yearning going on in the songs. So,
yeah,
I appreciate that you picked up on that.
Oh yeah, I definitely want to thank you for that, because that part of it. I mean, I'm having trouble myself dealing with, you know, the fact our daughter's older and, you know, she's the only kid. There's going to be no more of those times. And I loved those times. I was kind of almost a stay-at-home dad, you know, for many years with her. And I'm just having trouble with that passage of time. And your music definitely helps with that, and it will continue to help with that. So I just thank you for that, because that's a beautiful thing.
Wow, that really means a lot. I appreciate you saying that.
Thank you.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the big deal that I learned from the Ram Dass and Alan Watts lectures is attachment, you know, like... acknowledging the truth that things will always change, and somehow finding peace in that is going to serve you really well. The pain or fear you're feeling is directly related to your attachment to that relationship, or it can be attachment to things or to outcomes or to people and all that. Managing attachment and still enjoying what you have. You can be materialistic and have a bunch of stuff, but it's about how you relate to it. You know?
Yeah.
You know, your daughter will grow up. You either can relate to it as a loss and a fear and attachment, or you can acknowledge it as the natural progression of time and realize that you, inside you, somewhere, you have all those times still, you know?
Hmm. Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense. Maybe I'm a better songwriter than a therapist.
Well, you are a, you know, you're a songwriter and a therapist, and every... Everyone, Chris Ballew is probably one of the best people there is on earth. So go check out his stuff. I'll have all his stuff linked in the description. And Casper Baby Pants, President of the United States, new stuff. I can't wait to hear more of the new stuff than I have, which I have not heard much, but that's going to change. But listen, thank you very much, and I appreciate it. Please have a great day.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Day.
You bet, man. Thanks a lot for having me. I appreciate it. And yeah, keep on keeping on. Into a dream made of light. Made of light. Love you so there's no space in between. Sink into a sea so deep and warm. Made of light. Made of light. Full of love that has no shape or form. The stars, the world, and you and me. Made of light. Made of light. As you grow, just know that everything is made of light. Made of light. All dissolves and falls into a dream. Made of light. Made of light. Love you so there's no space in between. Love you so there's no space in between. Love you so there's no space in between. Love you so there's no space in between.